Midstream.
Iran has been facing a great siege and harsh sanctions imposed by the warmongering West, but it achieved self-sufficiency and came out victorious. The West then tried both soft and direct wars through external interventions to disrupt internal life in the Islamic Republic in the form of sedition schemes, terrorist movements, and media incitement, yet Iran revealed what's behind the Western masks. Of course, it is not possible to visualize the Iranian scene in isolation from the failure of the Zionist American axis in forming a reality that is consistent with their unattainable goals. However, that vision brings clarity as to who are the parties behind the riots and the systematic attacks on the Iranian people in supporting, planning, and funding rioters, from capitalizing on the case of the young woman Mahsa Amini to the fanatic bombings and the arrest of cells belonging to terrorist organizations. This has been the plan put forth by the administration of George Bush and continues to this day, a strategy that puts the United States of America in open conflict with Iran, Iraq, and Syria. It calls for concealing the role of the real motivators, actors, and organizers of forming an extremist and sectarian front, maintaining the secrecy of U.S. and Israeli support, and showing cooperation through Saudi networks, which are obsessed with Iran's role in the region. Hence, the scene today can be read in multiple directions, the most important of which is the decline of American hegemony during its wars since after the events of 9/11, in contrast to the growing power of its target, the Axis of Resistance in particular. This is factual despite its notorious policy of drowning its enemy in crises, as was evident in the 2006 Lebanon July War, the 2009 Gaza War, and the global war against Syria since 2011, all the way to the current Western-made events inside Iran. At this point, an important theme emerges that needs to be addressed, which is the birth of the New World Order, whose keys are in the hands of the Eurasian bloc, the bloc that threatens America's leadership and attempts to pull the rug of control from under its feet in West Asia. The nature of the successive changes on the Western Axis imposes on it to play in multiple arenas at a time when the nature of alliances is changing, orientated towards a more solid and ascending stage, including the main players in Asia, Iran, Russia, and China. This opened the way for their Western enemy to enter center stage with fabricated crises. What the Islamic Republic of Iran is being subjected to today strongly demonstrates the aggravation of Iran's enemies by its growing strength. This does come within the framework of Western malicious plans blatantly announced by the American intelligence departments and politicians. However, the confidence in the ability to repel these fabricated waves of Western aggression is far greater than what Iran's enemies might think. Welcome to the Middle Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. As the identity of the parties behind the riots and the systematic attacks against the Iranian people became clear, from the case of the late young woman Mahsa Amini to the bombings and the arrest of cells belonging to the terrorist organization Daesh, it was imperative to look back historically, and in particular, since after the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979, the United States of America has worked using the same tactic, that is divide and conquer, to expand its influence in West Asia through British-made radical groups, also supported by it and with American Arab facilitation. To discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Dr. Mustafa Khoshashm, academic and political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Khoshashm. Now, Iran's enemies tried concealing their role as real motivators, actors, and organizers of forming an extremist and sectarian front against the Islamic Republic and maintaining the secrecy of both American and Israeli support to terrorists who attempted to ignite Iran. Yet the Islamic Republic was able to dissect those behind the sabotage and expose the Western hegemony. What do you think Iran's next move will be?
This is a scheme that has been repeated and that has been underway by the United States whenever Iran and the United States are at a willpower, a war of willpower. Then the Americans start a pretty known and notorious formula against Iran that includes hybrid warfare in more than a dozen areas. They try to fight against Iran indirectly in different areas of media, of foreign currency, of oil supplies to the foreign countries, as well as at international bodies through terror and assassination and so on and so forth, in order to push Iran back. Like this actually started under President Obama, but it has always been at work whenever there's been, some kind of resistance between, I mean, from the side of the Iranians. The last time that we experienced this war of willpower was in the spring, when Iran and the United States were at raw, actually, over a couple of issues remaining under the JCPOA talks, in the JCPOA talks. And then in spring, the first round of this war of willpower started. The formula, the consequence, and the sequence, actually, of each move to be made by the United States is pretty well known. Even the duration of each move is known. It always starts with a number of what I call conspiracy theories, like Iran wants to assassinate this and that guy, wants to kidnap this and that guy, and then wants to explode this place or that place. They don't mean to really prove anything at court or at international bodies. They just mean to damage Iran's reputation for the next stage. The next stage is actually targeting the Iranian public opinion, and that's what I call a war of perception or cognition. Then they try to misrepresent the situation. Like in this round of the second round of war willpower, before Mahsa Amini's story developed, when she was alive, they started lies about the life and death of the Iranian supreme leader. It's not just about Iranian opposition TVs. We're also talking about New York Times and many others who claim that Iranian supreme leader's health conditions is aggravating, that they even allege that he has already died. For five consecutive days, they promulgated this lie, because when you do that, then those that support the Islamic Republic grow concerns, and then those who want to start rioting or anything like that, they are encouraged and provoked, and they see some kind of hope for their movement. Well, then the next is
it's also, if I may, Mr. Khashashm, it's as you said, it's some sort of a hybrid war on many fronts and multiple fronts. And one of the most important front that they have been using ever since the Islamic Revolution was the industrial slowdown, accelerating the trend towards establishing regional monetary or banking blocks, fragmenting global trade, dismantling the global economy, especially the economy around Iran, as methods of instability and of also using corruption, until reaching some sort of Iranian fragmentation or dismantling of the Islamic Republic inside of Iran. But why has this plan not achieved its goal yet, despite the fact that it has been in place since 1979?
Well, first of all, let me complete this complete process. One aspect, one of the areas that deal with, is exactly what you said. I mean, simultaneous with rioting, they go for cyber attacks, massive cyber attacks. And then when you deal with rioting, according to all internationally recognized and acceptable and endorsed protocols, then they start, imposing sanctions, human rights sanctions on you, claiming that you have killed this one or that one, as if no one is killed in the United States during riotings. Only in this year, some 700 people have been killed by the police, not in rioting, but just, in everyday life. The police has killed 700 people. The same happens in other countries. Errors, mistakes happen everywhere. But when you are the targeted nation, they don't care if one-third of those that have been killed in this rioting have been from the Basij, IRGC, and law enforcement police forces. One-third. That's a lot. That means that you don't want to kill the population. As a matter of fact, you are coming under attack, but they don't consider that. Then they go for sanctioning you to, you know, damage your reputation again. Then they go for foreign currency meddling in your economy to disturb the market, destabilize the market. Next move, disturbing your the flow of your oil supplies to the foreign customers. Mm-hmm. Next move, using Mossad for terror, assassination, sabotage at nuclear industries, at, you know, like what happened in spring. Then they use IAEA or other international bodies to levy pressure, political and diplomatic pressure on you. The last step is a military threat, but of course the United States has not been powerful in the last 1.5 years to pose any kind of threat. So this time Biden came to the region with four goals and objectives. The first one was this, that if you don't sign the treaty, the JCPOA, then I will start a coalition of Arabs and Israelis to, you know, confront you, because they are leaving, they are being the Americans are being expelled from the region. Mm-hmm. They are afraid that what could happen with regard to Iran's regional growth. So this is a formula. They started this again after the Vienna talks, exactly. The conspiracy theories, the war of perception, rioting, cyber attacks, disturbing Iran's oil flow, foreign currency meddling, human rights, sanctions, mm-hmm. and then terror at Shah Cheral, and then sabotage. They've been doing that. They've been trying a lot. The Evin prison was one of the many cases that they tried to do sabotage. And then next week, you will see they are going to, you know, level up their threats at the IAEA. So this is a known formula.
Well,
Iran
in
has
one
worked
minute,
out.
Mr. Mustafa, we have one more minute left for this segment. How do you think Iran's official next step would be when you explain everything, all kinds of warfare that the West is trying against Iran? How do you think Iran will face all this?
Well, Iran has learned a lot in the last 1 or 2 decades, especially ever since Obama started this kind of formula against Iran. And they have worked out pretty well defenses in each and every area, not only diffusing their moves, but also reciprocating their moves. Mm-hmm. In overall words, I can say whatever they've done to Iran, the moves have not remained unanswered. But this is just the reaction. There is also active part which will come, like the Saudis, that's part of actually this coalition under the Abraham Accord, that they say that they have not signed it, but they are collaborating with the Israelis under the American schemes. They are supporting the terrorist organization, Iran International. We call it Saudi International, as a matter of fact. And also they have been funding all the operations in foreign currency meddling, everything. Mm-hmm. And the Israelis have been conducting this. So the Saudis are going to pay for that. And mm-hmm. that's a kind of active move that Iran is going to make. Of course, this is not going to necessarily be direct action, military action. It could come in a variety of ways.
Definitely. But Israel, and we have seen Iran previously try and deal with such a situation, especially with regional countries like Saudi Arabia and others. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for this segment. Thank you very much. From Tehran, Dr. Mustafa Khoshesh, academic and political commentator, for showing us the scene inside of Iran. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about something called a sham elections in Bahrain.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Bye. Bahraini opposition forces announced a constitutional document in which they affirmed they're striving for a new constitution for Bahrain and boycotted the country's elections. Now, the Bahraini opposition considers that the constitution enforced in the country since 2002 is imposed on the people, and it came as a coup against the first contractual constitution that was actually drawn up in election constituent assembly in 1973. Sham elections in Bahrain in this following report.
What happened in Bahrain during the election season was unfamiliar in the modern-day countries of the world, where the authorities are striving to pass their democratic carnival, to which foreigners are also invited, while the citizens who own the land are neglected and excluded from the elections by royal decisions. Bahraini King Hamad bin Isa ensured his control over the entire 2022 electoral process, from its management to supervision and scheduling of lists of those entitled to run for office and vote. This control is evident when examining the electoral block in Bahrain. Recalling the numbers of previous rounds, it appears that voters in 2006 were about 295,000, while in 2010 they reached about 318,000. And the number rose in 2014 to 349,000, until it became in 2018 about 365,000. But this year, it decreased to 349,000, according to announced official statistics. Logic says that the numbers of the electoral bloc increase proportionally every 4 years due to the demographic nature. But this year, this increase was not recorded, not because of a human or demographic imbalance, but because the system found this increase in voter statistics rise is harmful to the current regime. Accordingly, Al-Khalifa inclined towards the option of exclusion. So they worked on adjusting the numbers to suit their odds and be in favor of the regime's ballot boxes. In 2018, ahead of the parliamentary elections, the king issued a law amending Article 3 of the Decree on Exercising Political Rights, as a result of which some 80,000 members of dissolved political societies like Al-Wifaq, Islamic Action and Wad were removed from the electoral process. The law is still in force today, but the regime was not satisfied with banishing opponents to this extent, as it completed the policy of cancellation by removing more eligible voters this year too. 37,000 Bahrainis were simply eliminated from the voter registry. They were eligible citizens who chose to boycott the 2018 elections, even though their motives are not the same, which could be either for a political stance or due to illness or even travel. When calculating the size of the isolated bloc, it will be evident that the families of those who are prohibited from voting were also not allowed to participate in the polling day. Practically, the Bahraini authority removed a quarter of the voters from its lists, and this undoubtedly indicates that there is an imbalance in the real representation of the people, meaning that the entire process lacks transparency and credibility as per international laws and norms. The foregoing confirms that the Al-Khalifa regime wants to uproot the people who oppose its policy. Rather, the act amounts to the uprooting of opponents. Bahraini opposition members view this as a harsh eradication that they are subjected to in their homeland in exchange for granting nationalities to foreigners and aliens.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is lawyer Ibrahim Sarhan, legal advisor and human rights defender. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Sarhan. So Bahrain went ahead and did an election last week with 37,000 Bahrainis simply eliminated from the voters registry, added to the 80,000 that the regime had already eliminated before. Is that election a legal, a legitimate one that represents the people of Bahrain?
The elections that happened this year in Bahrain occurred while illegally eliminating 93,000 eligible voters from the voter registry. This elimination and political isolation was possible due to the act of confiscating the popular will, which began in 1975, when the king back then froze the 1973 parliament. Bahrain gained its independence in 1971, and then the Emir of Bahrain, Sheikh Isa bin Khalifa, vowed during his first speech that this independence will provide freedoms for the people of Bahrain and promised that the people will be the source of power in the country. The first constituent assembly was elected due to the draft constitution in 1971-1972, and the people of Bahrain voted for this constitution. As a result, the 1973 parliament came to be, but 2 years after the work of this parliament, it was frozen due to the so-called state security law, the law that the people of Bahrain objected to through parliament. And from that moment, that is, since 1975 on, there has been no popular will and no constitutional institution that expresses the will of the people of Bahrain. In 1999, when the emir died, the king came along and transformed the emirate into a kingdom and came up with the National Action Charter, which came in order to end the dignity uprising that occurred in the 90s. But this charter also stated that in the legislative authority there are two chambers, an appointed assembly and an elected assembly. All of these assemblies also failed to be adhered to by the King of Bahrain. The king tried to make parliament work according to its own size, so that it would have 18 seats for the opposition and 22 seats for his loyalists. Nevertheless, according to the distribution of these seats, there are discrepancies of more than 500%. For example, the electorate block in the opposition constituencies would be about 10,000 or 16,000, while the loyalist block constituencies does not exceed 2,000 or 3,000 votes, so that there would always be a huge difference in between both constituencies.
So, Mr. Hassan,
the thing that you're saying is that it is not only illegal, it does not definitely represent the people of Bahrain and the population of Bahrain. But we did see that there was a boycott from the opposition. For example, Al-Wifaq National Islamic Society issued a booklet containing 139 reasons to boycott what they called as the sham parliamentary elections that the regime conducted in Bahrain. Why not support opposition candidates instead of boycotting the elections? Mr. Ibrahim.
When the National Action Charter was implemented and the Constitution of the Kingdom of Bahrain in 2002 came to be unilaterally by the King himself, the opposition boycotted the first elections in 2022 due to the King's reneging of the covenant and its transgression of the popular will. In 2006, there were advices that the opposition go through the election experience to improve the situation or to pursue change from within this incompetent parliament. But this experiment in 2006 and 2010 did not bring encouraging results to continue. Therefore, the opposition withdrew in 2011 and the February 14 revolution began, after which three electoral experiments came through which the opposition did not take part in. The reason for the boycott is the deep problem associated with the Bahraini constitution. This problem cannot be resolved through parliament. There must be a serious intent by the King of Bahrain to change this constitution and to return the constitution to the popular will. It is not possible for this illegitimate institution to come up with a reform of the constitution of the Kingdom of Bahrain, which is based on Article 33, which gives absolute authority and allows the king to change the constitution himself. The problem is deeper than the election process. Because these elections are a sham and comic in a dictatorial regime with absolute power that neither the elections nor any of the constitutional institutions can change. There needs to be pressuring tools, and that's what we think will happen. We believe that in every generation there is a revolution inside Bahrain, and we believe that things are not promising to calm the situation in Bahrain. Rather, we expect that there will be an upcoming uprising or an upcoming movement in Bahrain.
This is what I want to ask you about, Mr. Ibrahim, in less than 2 minutes' time. You explained fully why it's not acceptable to take part in such elections, but what is the roadmap that the opposition can really take to stand in the face of what you call the authoritarian regime inside of Bahrain?
In 2012, there was a direct dialogue between the Secretary General of the Bahraini Al-Wifaq Society, His Eminence Sheikh Ali Salman, with the King, and then with the Crown Prince. Sheikh Salman presented a roadmap that the King did not respond to, and then the situation worsened. Today we are in 2022, and after more than 10 years of direct dialogue, Sheikh Ali Salman has been imprisoned, the spiritual father Sheikh Isa Qasim has been deported, and now the opposition is abroad, and there is opposition inside. There was a proposal from the opposition that there should be a memorandum of understanding or direct dialogue with the government of Bahrain, with the king directly. The opposition wanted to resolve the Bahraini crisis through dialogue. This call now, after 12 years, was not heard from the regime in Bahrain. We believe that the crises are cumulative, because the political crisis has led to a human rights crisis, an economic crisis, and a social crisis. Therefore, we expect that there will be an upcoming uprising for these reasons, because all calls are not heard. Neither the Human Rights Council is listened to, nor the European Union is listened to, nor the calls of the Western countries in Bahrain are listened to. Even any Arab initiative was not listened to. There is a complete rejection from the Bahraini regime, which does not want to solve this crisis. Therefore, we expect that there will be a new uprising to pressure the Bahraini regime.
So it seems that 2023 will be a very important year for Bahrain, for what the opposition might bring to the table. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ibrahim Sarhan, legal advisor and human rights defender from Beirut, speaking to us about the so-called elections that happened in Bahrain last week. Thank you for your time. Thank you, and I'll see you again next week. Salaam alaikum.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Limelight. China's Daocheng Solar Radio Telescope is among a suite of instruments the country has built in the past 3 years to study the sun. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The scientific publication Nature wrote, on the edge of the Tibetan plateau, engineers just finished mounting the final pieces of hardware onto the world's largest telescope array for studying the sun. Construction of the Daocheng Solar Radio Telescope, DSRT, which consists of more than 300 dish-shaped antennas forming a circle more than 3 kilometers in circumference, was completed on November 13th. Trial operations will begin in June. The 100 million yuan observatory will help researchers to study solar eruptions and how they affect conditions around Earth. We are entering the golden age of solar astronomy as we have lots of major solar telescopes coming online, says Maria Kazachenko, a solar physicist at the University of Colorado, Boulder. These include NASA's Parker Solar Probe, launched in 2018, and the European Space Agency's Solar Orbiter, launched in 2020, both of which collect data as they orbit the star. The sun is set to enter a highly active phase over the next few years. The radio frequency data DSRT collects will complement those gathered by telescopes working in other frequency bands. In the past 2 years, China has launched at least 4 sun-gazing satellites, including the Advanced Space-Based Solar Observatory in October, that study star at ultraviolet and X-ray frequencies. China now has instruments that can observe all levels of the sun from its surface to the outermost atmosphere, says Hoi Tian, a solar physicist at Peking University in Beijing. Observatories in China will also provide important data on solar activities that are not visible to telescopes in other time zones, says Ding Mingde, a solar physicist at Nanjing University. Solar research requires global collaboration, he adds. Radio telescopes such as DSRT are useful for studying activities in the sun's upper atmosphere, the corona, such as solar flares and coronal mass ejections, CMEs. These are giant eruptions of hot plasma from the corona that occur when the sun's twisted magnetic field snaps and then reconnects. When the high-energy particles released during a CME hurtle towards Earth, the resulting space weather can damage orbiting satellites and disrupt power grids on Earth. In February, a relatively weak CME destroyed 40 Starlink communication satellites launched by SpaceX, an aerospace company in California. Ding says, with an increasing number of satellites in space, there is an increasing need to better forecast space weather. Kazachenko says that predicting space weather remains a struggle. DSRT has a wide field of view, at least 36 times bigger than the sun's disk, which will allow the telescope to track the development of CMEs and observe how high-energy particles propagate through space, says Jing Yan, the chief engineer of DSRT at the National Space Science Center, part of the Chinese Academy of Sciences in Beijing. With this information, we may be able to forecast whether and when coronal mass ejections will reach Earth, says Yan. DSRT's 313 antennas will allow it to achieve high sensitivity for better space weather forecasting. The large array could potentially capture weaker signals from high-energy particles that might be missed by arrays observing at the same frequency range, from 150 MHz to 450 MHz with fewer antennas, such as the Nanki Radio Heliograph in France, which has 47 antennas, says Yon. DSRT's observation data will be made available to international researchers, says Yan, and China's National Space Science Center, which oversees DSRT's operation, plans to open the telescope at night for other types of observations, such as pulsar research. China is also building a new optical telescope on the Tibetan Plateau in Sichuan that is expected to be completed in 2026. The website of space.com wrote in this regard, the development is part of a ground-based space environment monitoring network called the Chinese Meridian Project. The project also includes the Chinese Spectral Radio Heliograph for monitoring solar activity, which is being constructed in Inner Mongolia. The radio heliograph will consist of 100 dishes in a three-arm spiral arrangement that will study the sun in a wider band of frequencies than DSRT to further Chinese research of the sun, solar physics, and space weather. The entire project aims to run close to 300 instruments deployed at 31 stations across China at specific longitudes and latitudes. It is led by the National Space Science Center, NSSC, of the Chinese Academy of Sciences and involves more than 10 institutions and universities in China.
8-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Recent efforts made by the U.S. and allies in West Asian region trying to sow discord among ethnic and religious groups in places such as Iran have had reverse results. Case in point, today in Iran, the Turks, Kurds, Baluchs, Arabs, Shiites, Sunnis, Christians and Jews have good relations among themselves and with the Iranian government. Even some groups that previously had some conflicts and differences with establishments that led to the recent unrest are today cooperating with it to find peaceful resolutions, despite what the US, Israel, and Saudi Arabia desired. In their latest meeting, heads of the three branches of the Iranian government called on relevant bodies to act vigilantly in maintaining public order, security, and tranquility across the country. The officials also thanked the Iranian people for contributing to efforts to foil plots aimed at creating crises in the country. In recent remarks, the American President Joe Biden encouraged anti-government protests, saying, "We're gonna free Iran. They're gonna free themselves pretty soon." According to international law, Biden's remark is indicative of blatant foreign interference. The Americans and other enemies sought to destabilize Iran by implementing the same plans as in Libya and Syria, but they failed, President Raisi was quoted telling the local media. "By contrast, Iranian cities are now safe and sound," Raisi said, promising retribution for the riots and vandalism the country had experienced lately. To take a closer look at what's actually taking place in different corners of Iran right now, stay with us on this edition of Iran Today. The streets of Tehran have been largely quiet as the Iranian government attempts to signal that life has returned to normal after a few weeks of protests and sometimes bloody riots. But if the streets are now quiet after the unrest, there are signs that there is a challenge taking place and heightening within the establishment itself about the management method of the recent events and socio-political solutions for the causes of the unrest. In another gesture apparently intended to show the crisis is over, the government says it will allow the citizen groups to hold rallies again in the future provided they meet strict preconditions. Under the law of the Islamic Republic, citizens have the right to public assembly so long as the rallies are peaceful and not against the values of the Islamic Revolution.
In this encounter with America, there are certain attributes that are fundamentally different from the many plans and programs that we had been facing since the victory of the revolution. In two or three words, these attributes can be defined. First of all, this is really an international war against the Islamic Republic. Secondly, this is a hybrid war in technical expression. It depends on information, organization, and expertise. The third attribute is the fact that this is a complicated war with interwoven elements.
So despite the misrepresentation by the Western media and Persian language opposition media outlets, normal life goes on in Iran. Shopkeepers go to their shops, students attend their classes. Many people haven't even encountered a single demonstration personally, but the Western affiliated media makes it look like a revolution is going on in Iran. In such a way that if a person enters Iran from another country today, he or she would think that something is wrong. This doesn't match the description of Western media outlets.
As we speak right now, we are close to the Vanias Square, which has been one of the hot spots in the recent protests. If you were looking through the cyberspace lenses, most likely you would have felt the place was burning in fire. This is what media does, cognitive warfare, change of perception. If you look carefully, the Western media is making their people see us as they please. Another aspect of what they're doing is to make our people see them as they prefer. But what they've been concentrating on during the recent unrest is that our people see them and us as they please.
In fact, experience shows that the countries which are typically deemed turbulent and unsafe by the Western media, such as Iran, are often actually the safest and most remarkable ones. According to most tourism experts, Iran has some of the kindest and friendliest locals you could ever meet. There are so many social and cultural misconceptions out there, and Iranians are always trying to debunk as many of them as they can.
There is a tight and meaningful relationship between most of the provinces in the country that are made up of different ethnicity, culture, history, language, and living conditions. However, these people live under a single umbrella called Iran. They never put their lower Azeri, Baluch, Arab, Turkmen ethnicities higher than being an Iranian. And this is the reason for their unity and coherence. Also, Islam brings additional unity and coherence for them. Because of that, we have an annual event in the Islamic Republic called the Islamic Unity Week. And during this week, all the Sunni and Shia leaders of the country and the region gather together to prove that we are not for conspiracy or internal conflict. Our enemies want to undermine this very strength of ours.
Iran is an incredibly underrated country with an immense history, the beauty of its landscapes, the details of its stunning architecture, the hospitality of its locals, the unique villages that still hold on to their centuries-old traditions, and so much more rarely ever gets represented in the news. Tourists who have spent time in Iran commonly believe it should be on every traveler's bucket list. However, the beauty of Iran is rarely shown in the Western media. Sadly, it's always buried underneath scary footage that only reflects the world of politics, the kind of politics that's twisted enough to fit the interests of its antagonistic foes.
These incidents have created a great opportunity, in my opinion, things we haven't paid enough attention to in the past. The most important is the fact that we must pay attention to our youth. They were emotionally provoked with some issues to come to the streets. They should be taken seriously and respectfully. We might have overlooked them due to the corona years. The other opportunity is about our universities. The Islamic Republic, since its beginning, has insisted on political environment inside the universities. But now our universities are vibrant again. Officials are visiting them more frequently now, and a good dialogue is taking place there. We need to continue on this path to reach higher grounds of free thinking.
Despite the exaggerated news coverage of recent protests in Iran, one has to be cautious in interpretation of the events and prediction of the outcome. Perhaps for Iran, the path to democracy zigs and zags and sometimes moves in ways that some people think is forward and others think is moving back, or so. While some commentators have gone so far as to call the demonstrations a women's revolution, this seems to go too far, according to socio-political experts. Political scientist Patrick O'Neill identifies a revolution as a form of political violence and the public seizure of the state in order to overturn the existing government and the regime. The current demonstrations in Iran do not match these definitions, although people are chanting against some government policies. But they seem to be more of an outcry for justice in certain segments of social life. Additionally, the demonstrators definitely have not pursued the seizure of the state.
The other opportunity has to do with the media. One of the most serious blows we encountered has to do with our media efforts. Our media acted weak and passive. We didn't take advantage of our past experience. For example, we were slow to cover the Ukraine plane accident. We were slow to cover different aspects of Mahsa Amini's story, such as the security camera footages. Overall, there is an absence of a role for the media in strategic and important national issues is being felt. The last but not least opportunity has to do with the Responsibility Act of the Islamic Republic, which is one of the most democratic systems in the world. Our power comes from the people, and we have to respond to them more swiftly in critical situations.
Another key ingredient for revolution is missing. So far, the security forces of the Islamic Republic remain intact, and the state has continued to rely on the law enforcement forces and plainclothes agents to calm down the rioters. Meanwhile, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, which is tasked with protecting the revolution from internal and external threats, has not been deployed, perhaps because the state feels secure enough without it.
In fact, it's a hybrid war. Let me describe it to you. It's actually a mixture of all elements. For instance, they used a qualitatively diverse group of people in appearance, such as religious clergy, university professors, Daesh operatives, university students, high school students. They didn't need a large quantity of these people. Instead, they used a variety of types. This allowed them to produce content more easily, also make the message more believable by hearing it from a variety of people.
One should also keep in mind that at the moment, major cities including Tehran, Mashhad, Tabriz and Shiraz remain completely in the control of authorities, despite sometimes witnessing riots and clashes with security forces. There have also been some reports of a strike, but they are not widespread, nor has there been the closure of the Tehran Bazaar, which characterized the Islamic Revolution.
In the case of interactive media, it is the message that comes towards the user, not the user goes towards the message. In this case, the message chooses its audience. What happens next is that they influence your views by bringing interesting doubts into concrete realities. This way, they make you doubt your judgment even about things you were very certain before. The opposite can be used to project things positively too, meaning that by this sort of manipulation, you could perceive your enemies as friends.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
There is a lack of viable political alternatives. Opposition to the Islamic Republic is either weak or fractured, irrelevant or rejected by most of the people of Iran. They include outdated supporters of the monarchy and the MKO, which is widely despised by Iranians of all political stripes because of their siding with Saddam Hussein when Iraq invaded Iran during the 1980s, and also many acts of terrorism on Iranian ordinary people and officials.
Ordinary people never go along with violence, and no ordinary person, be it a shopkeeper or an academic or a student, none of them would take up a knife in protests. The best they do is hold up a banner. But these rioters showed up with knives, weapons and so on. They really turned the streets into war zones. People saw that after 40 years in which they have gained such a high level of experience in political matters. They are unique in that sense. They won't get fooled easily. They are not deceived easily by media tricks. Therefore, ordinary people didn't participate in these sorts of action from the beginning, and this thwarted the rioters' plots.
Although the current unrest would have faded out one way or another, the government is determined to address some of the concerns of the protesters. This process will naturally take some time, but it is never forsaken. In this context, President Raisi, while addressing the unrest in the country, told the local media that some reforms in the implementation of some laws may be necessary.
Two issues need to be separated. One is the protest and the other is the riot. Protests still exist and it's within the community of the people. At different levels of the society, protests regarding cultural, social or economic issues exist. And this is completely natural. And the leadership says they are often right demands. So it's something that the establishment officially accepts, respects it, and there should certainly be an appropriate response for it. But what's illegitimate is the issue of riots, which seems to be over now.
There is plenty more right after a quick diversion into world media. Here is how it looks on the page. Iran arrests agent of London-based opposition TV channel. Iranian armed forces have arrested an alleged employee of an opposition television broadcaster, Iran International, while the individual was fleeing the country, the semi-official Fars News Agency said last week. Recently, the agents carried out numerous activities and actions in slandering the Islamic Republic, inviting youth to riot and creating terror among the people, Fars said about the arrest. Iranian media identified the arrested individual as Elham Afkari, who they say had been in contact with the TV channel. Tasnim News Agency says Iran wraps Germany's own diplomatic stance, warns of firm response. The foreign minister of Iran hit back at its German counterpart for her provocative and undiplomatic remarks about the Islamic Republic, warning Berlin that Iran would show a proportionate and firm reaction. In a post on his Twitter account on Thursday, Hossein Amir Abdullahian deplored the anti-Iran stances adopted by German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock. He reminded Baerbock in the tweet that provocative, interventionist and undiplomatic stances don't signal sophistication and wisdom. Undermining old ties has long-term consequences, Amir Abdullahian warned. Tehran Times news agency says eight countries trained riot leaders, Iranian Interior Minister. The US, Israel, Saudi Arabia and several European nations directly incited unrest in Iran, according to Iranian Interior Minister Ahmad Vahidi, who said that the leaders and organizers of those unrests were carefully trained in eight countries for these unrests. Vahidi, who was speaking with the Shia and Sunni clerics in Gorgan, Golestan province, reiterated, "In the course of the recent plot, countries such as Germany and Britain too, alongside Saudi Arabia and the Zionist regime, had openly established headquarters and were busy supporting the rioters." He said these countries attempted to turn the current events into racial conflicts by pretending to favor certain Iranian tribes and ethnic minorities. The Interior Minister emphasized that the oppressors' fake sympathy for nations had been demonstrated in the past, citing their backing for the massacre of Iraqi Kurds and Sunni Muslims in Mosul as examples. A few days ago, Iran's foreign minister, in a phone conversation with the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, criticized security and media meddling by an Arab country in recent protests and deadly riots in the Islamic Republic. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said, "In contradiction to the UN Charter, a few Western governments acted to encourage violence and offer training on making arms and Molotov cocktails in the cyberspace and media by exploiting peaceful protests in Iran, which resulted in the killings of police personnel and the creation of insecurity in Iran, to the extent that they paved the way for an act of terror by Daesh in Shiraz."
"We should also admit that our media power is not comparable to the enemies. Our war is also an equal war. They utilize many satellite networks such as BBC, Iran International, Manotov, and many others that have turned into a war room now. They blatantly tell their viewers how to hit security forces, how to make Molotov cocktails, how to shoot weapons, and if you get arrested, how to answer your interrogator, how to twist facts. This is all thought in these networks. This is why we can't put an image of General Soleimani in Facebook. because they'll close your account right away.
According to Iranian officials, the head of opposition media that influenced riots and vandalism in the country is Iran International, which has assumed the responsibility of increasing hostilities and unrest in Iran as the Saudi media arm. This network no longer does media work, but in fact acts as a terrorist organization that seeks to destabilize Iran. In the past, this network had interviewed people who were doing acts of terrorism in Iran in an attempt to provoke Iranian citizens. There is no one in the media world who does not know that Saudi oil dollars are behind the attractive appearance of this network.
We see Iran International as a media related to the Saudis. This media makes public protest calls on its own. This is really important because they get no response at the street level. If we review the events from the start onwards, it seems that at first some sparkles took shape at our universities, this sparkle transitioned to the streets and again died down on the streets and returned to the universities and finally died down there too.
Iran's intelligence minister Ismail Khatib recently offered a detailed analysis of the hybrid war the enemies have waged against the Iranian nation. In reference to media aspects, he said, currently, the media based in England is seeking to create and spread riots in Iran. Both in the past and at present, their media outlets have stepped beyond the field of directing riots and are seeking to organize malicious movements and acts of terrorism inside the country.
Right now, in response to the hybrid war, what we need to do is to form our lines of defense and offense, which is happening at the moment. In terms of cyberspace environment and cognitive aspects, we had some problems. For instance, instead of developing and commercializing our domestic software capabilities, we've been using foreign softwares that don't give us any degree of control over the product and actually gain control over us as users. In this sense, we've been giving away our most important asset, which is the public information, to foreign companies that use it against us. Nobody does it. Europe never does this. Americans, Chinese, and Russians never give their public assets to their enemies.
Unfortunately, the British government, which operates the BBC and Iran International satellite stations with its support and within its media framework, has taken on a terrorist role today. And this means they are crossing the red line of the Islamic Republic of Iran's security.
While they were preparing a plan to start their scheme, we were negotiating with the Saudis. During Rouhani's government, we had four rounds of successful negotiations, as they were saying this themselves, and one round of negotiation during Mr. Raisi's time, who has been promoting the improvement of regional relations, meaning that these negotiations had so much force and energy behind it. It got to the point that an imminent exchange of diplomats were being discussed by each country's foreign ministry. So what happened to all that? We have the posture of war instead and the same old words of Mr. Bin Salman about bringing the war to Iran. First of all, Iran is completely and fundamentally against such approach that the US, Israel, and the UK would certainly reap the benefit from it. This is like falling for the trap to play their game. They would want us to get involved in a war with their sets of rules.
These attempts by the Saudi-financed media outlet is despite the fact that in Saudi Arabia, any comments against the government face punishments such as death penalty. Saudi authorities' execution of 81 men on March 12, 2022 was its largest mass execution in years, despite recent promises to curtail its use of the death penalty. Some of them had been convicted of protest-related offenses. Saudi activists told Human Rights Watch that rampant and systematic abuses in Saudi Arabia's criminal justice system suggest it is highly unlikely that any of the men received a fair trial. The chief commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says Iran's pledge of revenge against enemies over their role in the unrest across the country has filled them with fear and prompted them to send messages to Tehran asking it not to act on the promise.
We've never been faced with such a huge volume of violence at the street level. In 2009, it took 8 to 9 months before in the last couple of months, protests became violent. There was a time when every protest, even at the street level, was done in the form of silent slogans and peaceful demonstrations.
Major General Hossein Salami referred to